Chapter 11. The World Trade Organization. Drug Monopolies at the End of History. The post-ethical drug industry was destined to have global ambitions. It consolidated within the sole industrial power to survive World War II intact. It flourished, selling products for essentially bottomless markets at home and abroad. Not just any products, but wonder drugs like penicillin and streptomycin that seemed to fall from the robes of Jesus Christ himself. Spoonful cures for tuberculosis and infections that once meant certain death. The biggest and most ambitious of the U.S. firms developed expansion plans to conquer a world newly populated by nations emerging from colonial rule. It didn't matter that U.S. patents had no legal standing in these countries. They would buy American drugs because they had to, and most had just enough wealth, concentrated in a middle or creamy class, to make it worth the trouble. Then, in the late 1940s, the American century took a troubling turn. The United Nations and its do-gooder agencies began meddling in the health and development agendas of countries across Latin America, Africa, and Asia. This meddling focused on establishing public health systems, including public drug companies to provide cheap medicines for national and regional populations. More troubling still, these efforts enjoyed the backing of the U.S. government, now in a contest for the allegiance and affection of these same nations. Even before the post-war decolonization wave was complete, the countries shook off UN tutelage. The Global South as a political identity was born in 1955 in Bandung, Indonesia, where 120 low- and middle-income countries established the Non-Aligned Movement. Together, they would decide their own fates, independent of Moscow and Washington. This movement's political and development agenda was fleshed out further at the first UN Conference on Trade and Development in 1964, where the poorest of these countries formed a negotiating bloc to call for full decolonization and South-South cooperation. They called themselves the Group of 77. The Global South was alert to the role of intellectual property in the rich countries and within the U.S. pharmaceutical industry above all. They observed Pfizer's early efforts to enforce U.S. drug patents in Europe and left no uncertainty about their position. They considered intellectual property a purposeful fiction of the rich North, a neo-colonial tool used to block North-South technology transfer and siphon wealth in the other direction. The demands of the G77 grew more strident into the 1970s, becoming a regular feature of U.N. conferences and assemblies. They were framed as matters of justice, not charity. When these demands reached their crescendo in 1977, the drug industry had heard enough. Amid the calm of detente, the pioneers of corporate red-baiting decided their biggest threat was the Global South's generic drug industry. This alternative system posed a risk to their global expansion plans, but also represented a provocation and challenge that might one day reach the lucrative and always vulnerable home market. Unless it was countered, soon and with force, there was no telling what troubles it might bring. The South-based system that so worried the industry in the 1970s was led, as during the immediate post-war years, by Nehru's India. The small penicillin firm built by UN technicians in the early 1950s, Hindustan Antibiotics, had realized the vision of its architects and become the cornerstone for a prospering India-based generics industry that produced dozens of antibiotics and other essential medicines for the developing world. Just as the companies feared, its associated research center had expanded to a dozen facilities where Indian scientists provided the formulas that built India's global reputation as the pharmacy of the poor. One of the pivotal events in the rise of India's generics industry was a 1959 hearing convened by Estes Kefauver. In testimony delivered to a subcommittee, it was revealed that U.S. drug companies often reserve their highest markups for the small middle classes in developing countries, with India getting the worst of them. This was poorly received in India, and the resulting protests pushed Nehru to accelerate the timeline for his country's independence from Western drug makers. At the same time, New Delhi initiated overdue plans to replace the Rajara patent regime still on the books. This alarmed U.S. companies more than India's expanding public sector product line. Ignoring U.S. patents was bad, but drafting a law to formalize the temerity was worse. Again, it was the power of example that most alarmed the industry. An explicit refusal to recognize U.S. drug patents by Nehru's India would carry weight and influence throughout the developing world. A domino effect of such laws would remove the last legal strictures, however ceremonial, binding South-based drug companies to the patent regimes of northern countries. Legal rebuttals of monopoly medicine also threatened to undercut the permanent industry campaign to reinforce the official drug story in the American mind. The Kefauver hearings rattled executives by exposing shocking price differentials between branded drugs sold in the United States and generic versions sold abroad. The spread of alternative patent regimes likewise threatened troubling questions and comparisons back home. In 1970, India's legislature, the Lok Sabha, passed the country's first patent reforms since independence. The Patents Act was not as radical as it might have been. Modeled on the systems of Western Europe, it banned drug patents but allowed room for temporary monopolies on methods related to their manufacture. Since India had world-class researchers adept at reverse-engineering Western drugs, they usually came up with different and sometimes better methods in any case. The companies did not lie down but proceeded to lobby the government in New Delhi as they would in Washington, D.C. The Western corporations aligned with conservative sections of the Indian government to bitterly oppose and obstruct the public drug sector and patent reforms, says Prabir Purkayastha, a veteran of the Indian People's Health Movement. Nehru's vision represented an especially fearsome threat, a developing country with its own scientific institutions, cutting-edge capacity, no patent protection, and factory lines that could provide pharmaceuticals to its own huge internal market in other developing countries. The U.S. pharmaceutical industry proved powerless to stop the Patents Act. Upon its passage, Merck CEO John Connor, who served under Vannevar Bush in the OSRD, announced the law, a victory for global communism. As Connor and his industry colleagues feared, the law indeed became a beacon and symbolic antipode to the capitalist model of monopoly medicine. G77 countries, from Southeast Asia to the Andes, used the Indian law as a model for their own patent systems, further dimming prospects for the U.S. pharmaceutical industry. On May 1, 1974, the G77 passed a declaration in the U.N. General Assembly calling for a new international economic order. The statement called upon member states to fulfill the UN Charter by eliminating the remaining vestiges of alien and colonial domination and neocolonialism in all its forms. The NIEO underscored patents and knowledge monopolies as among the greatest obstacles to the full emancipation and progress of the developing countries. High on its list of founding principles was giving to the developing countries access to the achievements of modern science and technology, and promoting the transfer of technology and the creation of indigenous technology for the benefit of the developing countries in forms and in accordance with procedures which are suited to their economies. The G77 took the NIEO agenda into the World Health Organization, where developing nations had the two-thirds majority needed to set policy. In 1973, the G77 agenda for patent-free North-South medical tech transfer gained a powerful ally with the appointment of Halfdan Mahler as WHO Director General. A Danish doctor who had spent a decade as director of India's tuberculosis program, Mahler supported the G77 agenda and spent the mid-1970s working with its governments on a blueprint to achieve health for all by the year 2000. The plan was unveiled in September 1978 at a WHO-sponsored conference on primary health care held in the Soviet city of Almaty, Kazakhstan. The resulting declaration of Almaty affirmed the agency's commitment to health as a human right, based on equity and social justice, and called for the creation of a WHO program to help G77 countries achieve self-sufficiency, a principal component of its plan to close the North-South health gap. UN assistance in building up domestic drug industries across the South. This was not health as a general concept, but involved concrete products, still mostly manufactured in the North. Later that year, Mahler released the first WHO list of essential medicines, a shot across the bow of the companies and cartels profiting off their control of those drugs' production and pricing. The G77 was claiming the right to the kind of institutional capacity that would make it self-sufficient in a pandemic, says David Leggy, an Australian co-founder of the International People's Health Movement, a global activist and academic network. The calls for a new international economic order and the declaration at Almaty were about scaling the model of the UN penicillin projects. Of the dozen or so executives atop the biggest U.S. drug companies, Edmund T. Pratt Jr. was the most unsettled by these events. Since being named CEO of Pfizer in 1972, Pratt had made a close study of the rising South-based generics industry and G77 assertiveness. A military man who served as Secretary of the Army in the Kennedy administration, he brought to the job a strategic long view on global threats to his company's international expansion plans, especially for drugs and agricultural products in Asia. After years of musing on the shape of a possible counter-assault, it was the scene at Alma-Ata, with its calls for UN-funded generics production, essential medicines as a human right, health for all, that finally forced Pratt into action. He had seen enough. In the winter of 1978, he gathered a few of his fellow CEOs for a meeting to hash out a plan. Pfizer was a natural choice to lead the industry's foray against the G77 and allied UN agencies. The company was legendary for launching kamikaze drug patent infringement suits around the world, just to spite foreign governments that refused to bow to the authority of the U.S. Patent Office. In 1961, it sued Britain after the country's National Health Service purchased Italian-made generic tetracycline, a Pfizer-patented antibiotic. Throughout Europe, where medicine patents were still nearly universally banned, the suit was a sobering introduction to the post-ethical U.S. drug industry. British and European editorials reminded readers that Pfizer owed its power to wartime contracts to produce fermented penicillin based on the discoveries of British scientists, who were directed by the government to place their work in the public domain. Pfizer lost its 1961 tetracycline suit against the British policy of royal use, then lost again when it sued the NHS for infringing on a different drug patent 4 years later. Pratt's initial plan did not involve activating his company's fleet of patent lawyers. Rather, he sought to build support for stronger intellectual property protections within the UN system, where the G77 was agitating for technology transfer. Given the majoritarian and consensus rules that govern most UN business, success was always unlikely. But in 1978, there were not a lot of options. The UN's World Intellectual Property Organization, or WIPO, was the only international forum for shaping intellectual property rules and settling disputes. The agency's main purview was the 1883 Paris Convention for the Protection of Industrial Property, a document limited to requiring signatories to treat foreign and domestic companies equally under their national patent laws. Pratt considered it a toothless convention, but also a possible toehold. Although WIPO and the Paris Treaty lacked enforcement mechanisms and did not legitimize patents outside of national borders, perhaps that could be changed from within. Following the Alma-Ata conference, Pratt focused on toughening the U.S. position ahead of a scheduled 1980 conference on the first revisions to the Paris Treaty since 1967. He did not have to work hard to get the government's attention. In 1979, Carter named Pratt to the Advisory Committee for Trade Policy and Negotiation, an elite board of a few dozen executives founded in 1974 to better align U.S. trade policy with the interests of leading U.S. companies. In the end, none of it mattered. Not the support of the Carter and Reagan administrations, not 2 years of planning and organizing. The U.S. delegation's proposals to even discuss strengthening patent protections ran smack into the 55 Paris Treaty signatories who also belonged to the G77. When Pratt's proposals met with stony stares from the South, the U.S. delegation noticed that its ostensible rich nation allies were staring at their shoes. In the estimation of a legal advisor to the German delegation, patent lawyer Hans-Peter Kunz-Holstein, the U.S. delegation was alone and almost isolated. The G77 didn't shoot down the U.S. proposals in defense of the status quo. They arrived in Geneva seeking to revise the Paris Treaty in the opposite direction and advance the agenda of the new international economic order. Preferential treatment, subsidized technology transfer, the right to circumvent patents and chains of production and trade. The U.S. patent lobby was taken aback by the unity and strength of the G77 negotiating position. If France, Canada, and Japan were half as committed to globalizing Western drug patents by force, Washington might not have to do all the work. The mood inside the U.S. drug and patent lobbies was captured by a statement published at the 1981 gathering of the American Bar Association's Patent, Trademark, and Copyright Division. The group called upon the newly arrived Reagan administration to withdraw from the Paris Treaty and denounce any amendments that allowed special dispensations or privileges for developing countries or imposed special burdens on developed countries. No formal statement announced a change in what was now the joint drug industry, White House position on global patent enforcement. But a break had occurred. Pratt believed the United States had tried to be reasonable, magnanimous even. They had made a good-faith effort to open a dialogue with the developing world on neutral UN ground and negotiate. But they had been insulted for their efforts, a victim of a UN system that gave equal weight to votes by Washington, Nairobi, and Mexico City. Pratt and his inner circle returned to the drawing board. Only now, they were cracking their knuckles. The experience with WIPO was the last straw in our attempt to operate by persuasion, Pfizer's general counsel at the time, Lou Clemente, later told researchers Peter Drahos and John Braithwaite, authors of Information Feudalism. Because the UN gave too much leverage to the G77 and its bureaucratic allies, a less democratic forum was needed. If such a forum did not exist, it would have to be created. Pratt's stature in the industry rose following the Paris Treaty debacle in Geneva. In the winter of 1981, the White House appointed Pratt and John Opel of IBM as co-chairs of the Advisory Committee for Trade Policy and Negotiation. As the Reagan administration intended, the executives focused the committee's work on the patent issue, establishing an intellectual property task force and stacking it with patent lawyers and executives from patent-based manufacturing associations. Most of them represented chemicals and pharmaceuticals, but the task force also featured new players in the budding high-tech information economy, entertainment, software, biotech, agriculture, semiconductors, who were learning to see the world through pharmaceutical eyes. The patent globalization train gained momentum during the Carter-Reagan transition year, but it still wasn't clear where it was going. This changed in 1982, when the industry administration nexus, overseen by Pratt and Opel, settled on a destination, the Uruguayan resort town of Punta del Este. It was there on a peninsula overlooking the South Atlantic that in September 1986, the next round of global trade negotiations would begin on the treaty known as GATT, G-A-T-T, or the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Since 1947, the GATT had been the closest thing to a rule-setting global trade authority, but it was a strange, disembodied kind of authority. It had no institutional home, no enforcement power, no governing directors, no president. It was a floating set of policies and norms updated every decade or so in negotiating rounds, named after the cities that hosted them. For the United States, where no daylight existed between the administration and Pratt's patent coalition, the upcoming Uruguay round of GATT offered an appealing structure. Approved amendments were often sweeping, all-or-nothing deals, hammered out in a format that slanted the advantage to the richest countries. That advantage, however, was only useful when all sides agreed on the agenda and were within negotiating range. That was a long shot in 1982. One, the Global South had made their unified position emphatically clear at the WIPO conference. The second problem was more fundamental. GATT was premised on the advancement of free trade. For three decades, its work focused on removing tariffs and other barriers to the flow of goods between nations. Patent monopolies, by definition, exist to restrain trade and limit competition. Moreover, intellectual property was understood as a form of protectionism within, not between, nations. Patents were dispensed and enforced according to national laws. Their legitimacy ended at water's edge. The patent-based industries weren't the first corporate alliance to attack this paradox. During the GATT Tokyo round, Levi's and other companies associated with famous trademarks pushed the U.S. delegation to establish an anti-counterfeiting code. The attempt failed. Developing nations rebuffed the ideas out of place. WIPO was the proper forum and hypocritical. GATT signatories from the Global South were unsympathetic to the plight of Western owners of luxury brands, write Drahos and Braithwaite. For years, the Western multinationals that controlled the packaging and distribution of food had made extensive use of the territorial insignia of developing countries, such as Darjeeling tea and basmati rice, without much regard for whether the products they were distributing actually originated from these regions. No one in the West considered that a problem. This discouraging precedent for the United States was a fresh memory. The Tokyo round ended in 1979 without a counterfeiting code. One result of the Tokyo round that proved useful to U.S. designs was a solidification of a novel trade concept, linkage, by arguing that an issue was a link to legitimate trading issues such as tariffs and quotas, negotiators could more easily place it on the agenda. This was the strategy used to pass amendments related to customs procedures and invisible export subsidies. If the United States couldn't even get a vote on protecting its iconic blue jeans, what hope existed for globalizing its monopolies on life-saving medicines, a concept that was only recently and after much debate accepted by Washington's closest allies? The political pieces, at least, were fully in place by 1982. Pratt and Opel's committee was working closely with the White House and trade officials. The most powerful patent and copyright-based industries had been educated and enlisted in the United States and in other wealthy countries. Some members of the U.S.-led coalition were considered weak links, notably Canada and Japan. But there was time to toughen them up in the 4 years remaining before Punta del Este. When it came to the broader business community and the public, there was still work to be done. Many small and medium-sized businesses saw patent monopolies the same way developing countries did, as weapons used by the strong against the weak. Small businesses had been central to the TNEC hearings on patents and were intentionally left out of post-war strategy sessions organized by the National Association of Manufacturers Committee on Patents and Research. Public opinion still bore the marks of scandals unearthed in the Senate investigations of Kefauver, Nelson, and more recently Ted Kennedy. The drug industry had struggled for decades to change public perception of patents. In the campaign around GATT, the old wine of innovation was paired with newer vintages labeled competitiveness and national security. Similar to the way Howard Foreman capitalized on public anxiety about economic decline to attack the Kennedy patent policy, the campaign marshaled by Pratt and Opel sought to rebrand the U.S. patent as a symbol of free enterprise and national primacy on the global economy. Nations that refused to recognize the authority of the U.S. Patent Office were rogue nations, pirate states, whose intellectual larceny threatened factory jobs in Detroit, rising high-tech industries in Silicon Valley, and the American way. To amplify and augment this message, Pfizer poured money into research projects at right-wing and centrist think tanks, including the Brookings Institution. Pratt personally took the message on the road, delivering rousing calls for action against piracy to business groups across the country. The campaign leaned hard on the idea that intellectual property was the same as any other kind of property, sacred, rarely, if ever, inviolable, and one the U.S. government had a duty to protect at home and abroad. The fact that this was not yet self-evident to the general public suggested that some things hadn't changed since the 18th century campaign that birthed the phrase intellectual property in post-revolutionary France. In a 1950 essay, economists Fritz Matchlip and Edith Penrose tell the story of how beleaguered patent advocates in the French Constitutional Assembly coined an apparent oxymoron to obscure the royal origins of monopoly and deflect attention from the true object of intellectual property claims, which is not knowledge but markets. Since markets don't fit easily into modern theories of rights and property, those who started using the word property in connection with inventions had a very definite purpose in mind, write Matchlip and Penrose. They wanted to substitute a word with a respectable connotation, property, for a word that had an unpleasant ring, privilege. They knew that there was no hope of saving the institution of patent privileges except under an acceptable theory, and in deliberate insincerity construed the artificial theory of the property rights of the inventor as part of the rights of man. A variation on this ruse was developed under the byline of Barry McTaggart, chairman of Pfizer International, in an op-ed that appeared in the New York Times on July 9, 1982, titled Stealing from the Mind. McTaggart informed readers that a tense worldwide struggle for technological supremacy was underway. The inventions of America's high-technology research-based industries have been legally taken in country after country by governments' violation of intellectual property rights, especially patents. He exhorted all freedom-loving nations to get in line behind the proper enforcement and honorable treatment of intellectual property, singling out computers, pharmaceuticals, and telecommunications as areas of knowledge being stolen by the denial of patent rights. McTaggart pointed a finger at the UN, where the G77 was trying to grab high-technology inventions for underdeveloped countries, an outrage that constituted an attack on the principle underlying the international economic system. In fact, no such principle underlay the international economic system. The deepest patent traditions were territorial. Drug patents, as the Pfizer executive well knew, had extremely shallow roots even in the richest countries of the North, where they cut against centuries of moral, ethical, legal, and scientific norms. It was not the pirate nations of the global South and Far East who were waging war on norms and principles. It was Pfizer. 5 years passed between McTaggart's op-ed and the U.S. government's announcement of its intellectual property agenda at Uruguay. In a letter to the GATT Secretariat, dated October 19, 1987, U.S. Trade Representative Clayton Yoder outlined a basic framework for the negotiations that amounted to what Drahos and Braithwaite call a declaration of principles of property wanted by big business for the coming global information economy. The G77 that faced this challenge was not the same G77 that called for a new international economic order and demanded health as a basic human right at Alma-Ata. By the mid-1980s, the global South was reeling from a debt crisis and tumult in the global political and economic order. Development funds and technology from the Soviet Union were disappearing, and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund were stepping into the void. This upstreaming of expertise and influence came at the expense of the UN Conference on Trade and Development, NCTAD, UNCTAD, the agency that during the 1960s and 70s had championed and assisted a G77 development agenda. UNCTAD no longer backed structural reforms to create a more just and democratic world system, and retreated into a technocratic role, focused on helping poor countries balance their checkbooks. We are now reduced to a shadow of what we were between 1964 and 1980, one agency official told researchers Quentin DeForge and Benjamin Lemoyne. There is a very strong opposition to the idea that UNCTAD continues to work on systemic factors, from the United States in particular, but also from advanced countries in general. The environment created favorable conditions for the U.S. strategy being readied for Uruguay. With few other options or institutional allies, developing countries were increasingly focused on selling raw materials and textiles to the United States and other wealthy markets. More than 100 countries had increased their trade with the United States since the 1976 establishment of the Generalized System of Preferences, GSP, a program designed to expand trade between the United States and the Global South. Both sides benefited from the program, but the poor countries were not in a position to dictate terms as its expiration approached in 1984. The law that continued the GSP, the Trade and Tariff Act of 1984, added an intellectual property requirement to participating countries ahead of Uruguay. Another amendment to the Trade Act passed that year created the stick to the GSP's carrot. It essentially weaponized the section of the 1974 Trade Act, Section 301, by making lax intellectual property enforcement a tripwire for investigation, censure, and retaliation by the U.S. government. The stick was named after the section it refashioned, Special 301. Washington's punishment-reward approach to softening up resisting nations made halting progress. In 1985, the United States rattled developing countries and its allies by brandishing the threat of Special 301 action against Brazil, Japan, and South Korea. That year, the Reagan administration cut U.S. support for the WHO over the anti-intellectual property implications of its essential medicines program. Clayton Yoder, the U.S. trade representative, announced that Special 301 was the new H-bomb of trade policy. His successor would praise it as a crowbar. Between 1984 and 1994, the United States invoked Special 301 in a dozen confrontations with G77 leaders, including one with India and three with Brazil, resulting in tariffs and reduced access to U.S. markets. When the Uruguay talks opened in September 1986, the United States had concerns on two fronts. One was a lack of zeal among its supposed allies. Canada, Japan, and European countries struggled to overcome attachment to non-monopoly drug traditions, including price controls and government support for generics. To help stiffen the spines of its allies and remind them what they signed up for, Pratt and Opel organized a new lobby group that year called the Intellectual Property Committee. Top-heavy with drug majors including Pfizer, Bristol-Myers, Johnson & Johnson, and Merck, the group's lobbying efforts included the publication of a handy 100-page pamphlet for negotiators to study called Basic Framework of GATT Provisions on Intellectual Property, Statement of Views of the European, Japanese, and United States Business Communities. The second, bigger problem was ongoing resistance to the basic framework by most of the Global South. Though many countries had been persuaded to drop their opposition, a number of countries pledged to fight. That number was steadily reduced during the first 2 years of the talks. By 1989, it had been whittled down to a core group of 10, led by the generic drug powers India and Brazil. That year, the Cold War ended, dooming the India-Brazil axis. The crumbling of the Berlin Wall liberated the United States from the need to practice international restraint, and it entered a historically unique period of global dominance. Inside the GATT negotiating process, the U.S. negotiators invited resistant counterparts into side rooms for chats that became known as black room consultations. This reflected a general post-Cold War impatience with going through the motions of compromise and negotiation. The GATT is beginning to smell like the United Nations, huffed Harvey Bale of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association to Inside U.S. Trade in January 1992, 2 weeks after the official dissolution of the USSR. U.S. officials ratcheted up the application of Special 301, opening investigations into 5 of the 10 hardliners opposing the draft document known as Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights, or TRIPS. India and Brazil, the leaders of the group, got the worst of it. Brazil broke first after the United States imposed crippling tariffs on its imports. India held out a little longer, but by 1990 had also succumbed to U.S. pressure. Under the terms of TRIPS, the country would have 10 years from the date of signing to revise its 1970 Patents Act to fit a mold cast by Western drug giants. The Nehru-era Patent Act was more than an institution of national pride. It was the foundation for a generics industry known as the pharmacy to the poor, the source of affordable treatments for malaria, cancer, and tuberculosis across the global south. When the news reached India, street protests against the government of Rajiv Gandhi broke out across the country. With the countries in line, it was left to the newly arrived Clinton administration to oversee the details. Not long before, Bill Clinton seemed to be an unlikely candidate for the role. He had campaigned against the unconscionable greed of health and drug industries that he had described as pursuing profits at the expense of our children. He identified the high price of drugs as one example of why the healthcare system doesn't work. None of those concerns remained when he toasted the globalization of drug patents that the vast majority of countries still considered unconscionable and unlawful. Clinton seemed genuinely happy at the ceremony in the Moroccan city of Marrakesh on April 15, 1994, when 124 states signed the final act of the Uruguay Round, bringing the World Trade Organization, WTO, into existence. According to the text of the treaty, the WTO heralded a new era of global economic cooperation, reflecting the widespread desire to operate in a fairer and more open multilateral trading system for the benefit and welfare of their peoples. In return for enforcing Western patents on medicines and other technologies, G77 nations were promised access to rich northern markets and a conditional freedom from fear of finding themselves on the wrong end of a special 301. At the time of the signing ceremony, this trade-off was widely reported as fair and consensual. It was neither, but the consensual part seemed to stick. A dozen years later, as sophisticated a critic of the WTO as Joseph Stiglitz would write, "As they signed TRIPS, the trade ministers were so pleased they had finally reached an agreement that they didn't notice they were signing a death warrant for thousands of people in the poorest countries in the world." Except they did know. It's the reason they fought as long and as fiercely as they did. It's why some negotiators from G77 countries called each other in tears when Brazil cracked, and why future WTO ministerial meetings would be held amid shrouds of tear gas. A lot of people understood perfectly well in 1994 that TRIPS was a mass death sentence. Before the end of the decade, everybody else would too. When the World Trade Association came into force on January 1, 1995, the only approved AIDS therapy was AZT, the repurposed cancer drug developed by the NIH and sold under patent by Burroughs Wellcome for $10,000 and more. In 1996, AZT reappeared as an ingredient in one of the first AIDS combination therapies sold by GlaxoWelcome, formerly Burroughs Wellcome, soon to become GlaxoSmithKline. As the news spread about the effectiveness of the new drug cocktails in interrupting the progression of the disease, the WTO was pressuring developing countries to speed up the process of reforming their patent systems in accordance with TRIPS. As with AZT, these antiretroviral therapies had been developed with heavy support from governments in the United States and Europe before their titles were transferred to the monopoly hands of GlaxoWelcome, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Boehringer Ingelheim. Like AZT, they hit the market with prices between $10,000 and $15,000 for a year's course. This priced out 99% of the world's 25 million AIDS patients. For many developing countries, the cost of providing the pills for every infected citizen would have exceeded the national GDP. For those who could afford them, the drugs transformed HIV from a death sentence to a chronic condition. Almost all of these people lived in northern countries, representing around 10% of global cases. The coming collision between rising AIDS numbers in the South and the new WTO-imposed patent regime was visible even before the promise of the new drugs had been proven. At the 1996 World Health Assembly, the Southern countries made a point of requesting that the WHO monitor the WTO's impacts on their access to new drugs and essential medicines. According to the letter of WTO law, these impacts were still in the future. The 1994 agreement gave developing nations 10 years to bring their patent laws into accordance with TRIPS. In theory, this was enough time to begin producing generic versions of the new combination therapies so urgently needed, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where in some countries up to a fifth of the population was at risk of an agonizing illness and death. But TRIPS had always been about the realities of power. The reality is we do not spend a lot of time thinking about legal issues when we negotiate GATT, wrote Emery Simon, a U.S. TRIPS negotiator, in a 1989 Law Journal symposium about the negotiations. The concerns that we have are with the commercial results, rather than with the legal niceties of it. In the late 1990s, the Clinton administration worked to ensure that the commercial results of trips were protected drug monopolies and unfathomable amounts of needless human suffering. When the clock started ticking on the 10-year TRIPS grace period, Washington began a pressure campaign on key countries to make their patent laws TRIPS compliant immediately, rather than waiting until 2005. In Brazil and Argentina, left-wing parties, unions, and civil society groups organized conferences to resist this pressure. All of them failed, buckling under threats by the United States and European nations to raise tariffs on its exports and block access to northern markets. Brazil legalized drug patents in 1997, all but invalidating another law passed the year before, guaranteeing antiretroviral therapy for its growing HIV population. Argentina posed a special challenge. The country's generic drug industry was the largest in Latin America and had the power to kill any bill, especially one as unpopular as a patent reform that would hurt the economy and sacrifice a decade of affordable drugs to appease Washington and foreign drug companies. In 1994, President Carlos Menem threatened to circumvent the strong parliamentary opposition by executive order. Though the gambit had dubious legal standing under Argentina's post-junta constitution, it was pushed hard as the best solution by the Clinton administration. Al Gore was dispatched to Buenos Aires during a Senate debate over the bill to remind Menem of the benefits of accelerating the TRIPS reforms and the potential costs of not doing so. James Love, a central figure in that era's emergent global medicines access movement, was also in Buenos Aires for the debate. Argentina was under a military dictatorship a decade earlier, and the U.S. was pressuring them to circumvent the parliament to shave a decade off their rights under the WTO, says Love. The U.S. was also leaning on them to eliminate their right to parallel trade, meaning the right to buy and import drugs from another market. European countries and the common market do this every day, but the U.S. was pushing Argentina to give up the right, also by executive order. It was very heavy-handed. I'd been fighting special interests my entire professional life, but Argentina was my introduction to the real face of U.S. policy on drug patents and TRIPS. Hyperinflation was causing extreme poverty across Argentina and Brazil. Shanty towns of cardboard boxes, and the U.S. government is sticking it to them on drug prices. In South Africa, the Mandela government passed a Medicines Act in December 1997 that gave the health ministry powers to produce, purchase, and import low-cost drugs. The industry backlash came fast. In February 1998, more than three dozen multinational drug companies and the South African Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association filed a suit against Nelson Mandela and the government of South Africa, alleging violations of the country's constitution and its looming obligations under TRIPS. Muddying the legitimacy of the suit, the South African commitment to TRIPS had been signed by the apartheid government of P.W. Botha in the late 1980s. The same Western leaders who continued to praise Mandela in public began chastising him in private meetings. In the summer of 1998, Al Gore put U.S. drug patents high on the agenda for that year's U.S.-South Africa Binational Commission. The U.S. Trade Representative, meanwhile, put the country on notice for retaliatory measures under Section 301. In his 2012 documentary about the generic AIDS drugs fight, Fire in the Blood, Dylan Moen Gray observes that it took the U.S. government 40 years to threaten apartheid South Africa with sanctions, but less than four to do so against the government of Nelson Mandela. Though South Africa was not a major market for multinational drug companies, it barely registered, in the drug industry's version of Cold War domino theory, the appearance of cheap drugs anywhere was a threat to monopoly-priced drugs everywhere, allowing the poorest nations to free ride on U.S. science, as the biggest companies themselves did, and build parallel drug economies would eventually cause problems closer to home, where the industry spent billions keeping the lid on public discontent over drug prices. The company suing Mandela had devised TRIPS as a long-term strategic response to the South-based generics industry that arose in the 1960s. They had come too far to be set back by the needs of Africans. They couldn't say this out loud, so they paired old standby arguments about patents driving innovation with racist pseudoscience. U.S. officials and industry figures claimed that Africans, if allowed broad access to combination therapies, would prove unable to follow instructions and take the drugs on schedule, thereby giving rise to new and dangerous drug-resistant viral mutations. Among the media figures who parroted this line was the HIV-positive blogger Andrew Sullivan, who at the height of the controversy was revealed as a recipient of undisclosed funding from the Drug Industry Trade Association. After the drug industry payments were disclosed and he was forced to end the sponsorship, Sullivan remained defiant. "It behooves me to say I see absolutely no problems with drug industry sponsorship," he told the reporter. "In fact, I am extremely proud to get some support from a great industry that has saved my and countless other people's lives, despite a massive attempt to penalize them for their work." Mandela's government held its ground under sustained pressure that some believe took forms associated with espionage against foreign enemies. In 1997, South Africa's health minister, the legendary activist Dr. Khozana Clarice Dlamini-Zuma, was summoned to Washington by Al Gore to meet with U.S. officials and drug company lawyers to discuss the Medicines Act. When Dlamini-Zuma met privately with two Medicines Access representatives in her room at the Watergate Hotel, U.S. officials contacted her immediately after, naming those same individuals in a reminder that outside experts were not welcomed in the following day's meetings. Dlamini-Zuma and the South African government suspected that the room had been bugged. The 52nd General Health Assembly opened in May 1999 as the African AIDS crisis and related drug controversy matured as issues of global public concern. The HOW building in Geneva was riven by a north-south fault line. On one side were the home countries of the Western drug companies, on the other the G77 countries and a rising third force of civil society groups. The immediate point of conflict was a resolution proposed by the Global South that the richest countries saw as a threat to the conquest of monopoly medicine achieved 5 years earlier with the founding of the WTO. The resolution described a revised drug strategy and called for WHO member states, 1, to reaffirm their commitment to developing, implementing, and monitoring national drug policies and to taking all necessary concrete measures in order to ensure equitable access to essential drugs, 2, to ensure that public health interests are paramount in pharmaceutical and health policies. 3, to explore and review their options under relevant international agreements, including trade agreements, to safeguard access to essential drugs. As global public opinion and WHO member state sentiment shifted further in favor of the resolution in the weeks leading up to the assembly, the companies and their allied embassies sought to turn the tide. Their angst is captured in a series of leaked cables that George Moose, the U.S. ambassador in Geneva, sent to Washington that April and May. In one, Moose expresses alarm over the growing number of WHO delegations making statements that public health should have primacy over commercial interests under WTO trade agreements, such as the TRIPS, trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, thereby potentially undermining intellectual property rights, IPR. Moose worried that the drug companies were not helping their own cause and seemed incapable of doing anything but parroting old talking points about intellectual property as the fuel of interest. "The pharmaceutical industry," Moose cabled on the eve of the assembly, "should be carrying more of its own water on this issue, especially in developing countries, and not solely depend on the argument that IPR protects profits that then are used for development of new drugs in the future. The South Africans and others are mostly concerned about availability of drugs now. Problems related to local availability and pricing of drugs that are unrelated to TRIPS will undoubtedly require further discussion." Over the course of weeks, a picture begins to emerge from Moose's accounts of the counter-mobilization against intellectual property rules written by U.S. drug company executives. It is the image of a pharmaceutical industry against the ropes, punch drunk and out of ideas. After walking into a buzzsaw at the 1999 World Health Assembly, the industry would botch an attempt to negotiate lower prices on AIDS drugs and tumble onto the doorstep of what the Washington Post called close to pariah status. It was around 10 o'clock in the morning of November 30, 1999, when an armored police vehicle blasted a canister of tear gas into the intersection of 6th Avenue and Union Street. Whoever fired the weapon had decent aim. Landing in the dead center of the axis, the chemical bloom scattered hundreds of protesters sitting in the street. Most made dazed and staggering escapes, some screaming in pain. Others wrapped T-shirts around their faces and returned the fuming canisters to their source. Trade officials in town from more than 100 nations were told to stay in their hotel rooms. The Battle of Seattle had begun. The size and intensity of the protests against the World Trade Organization surprised even their organizers. Trade negotiations were supposed to be low-profile affairs conducted away from public notice in luxury hotel conference rooms. 5 years after the creation of the WTO in Morocco, Seattle announced the end of the era of sleepy trade rounds passing unnoticed in the developed world. The accelerating U.S.-led process called globalization had produced consequences at odds with the decade's free trade mantra. A global network of civil society groups emerged to challenge these mantras, but Seattle demonstrated the difficulty of synthesizing them into a coherent narrative. The diversity of causes and institutions seen on anti-globalization protest banners in Seattle, labor standards and development loans, free trade and sea turtles, genetically modified seeds and public health budgets, gave champions of the new economic order an opening to dismiss its mostly youthful challengers as, at best, romantic naifs, too ignorant to understand that the world of Washington-led free trade was the best of all possible worlds. Before the smoke had cleared, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman described critics of this world as a Noah's Ark of flat-earth advocates, protectionist trade unions, and yuppies looking for the 1960s fix. The drugs at issue in Seattle were not the recreational kind suggested by Friedman's metaphor. Since the WTO signing ceremony in Morocco, the AIDS epidemic had worsened across the developing world. By 1999, the virus was the leading cause of death in Africa. Poor countries had put barriers to generic AIDS drugs on the list for discussion by the TRIPS Council in Seattle, which placed it at the bottom of an official agenda. At the top was a lengthier description of the problem of geographical indications concerning the scope of protections enjoyed by national products named after places such as Champagne, Tequila, and Roquefort. This north-south rift, French negotiators concerned about naming rights on cheese, their African counterparts pleading for the right to save millions of lives, was ultimately what doomed the Seattle talks, more than the police protest and melees on television. The talks ended in stalemate with no schedule to resume. In March 2001, the South African government called the drug company's bluff by allowing the case to go to court. An attempt to scare and intimidate South African officials had ended with the companies under the harsh lights of growing international scandal, suing Nelson Mandela to maintain rules that were killing thousands of people every day. The lawsuit wasn't the only driver of global attention to the issue. Weeks before the industry's lawyers delivered their opening argument to the Pretoria High Court, the New York Times published a bombshell by Donald McNeil Jr. titled, "Indian Company Offers to Supply AIDS Drugs at Low Cost in Africa." An Indian drug company called Cipla was offering to make generic combination therapies and sell them to poor countries for less than a dollar a day. The company represented everything that TRIPS had been designed to snuff out. The company's founder, Khawaja Abdul Hamid, had been influential in shaping the Indian nationalist movement's view of scientific development as a state-level expression of Gandhian self-reliance. Mahatma Gandhi would sanction this relationship in a visit to Cipla's laboratory shortly before his assassination. Hamid's son, Yusuf, followed his father's political example and took pride in India's role as pharmacy to the world. Following the Times report, the industry position, always weak, became untenable. The patent-based drug companies were now seen to be blocking a solution that required only that they get out of the way. The figure offered by Cipla, $350 per year, exposed Big Pharma's sticker prices as bloodstained shams, including its $4,000 concessional price. Under the circumstances, the industry did the only thing it could do. In April 2001, it quietly dropped its suit against the Mandela government. Its attention turned to Doha, the antiseptic seaside capital of the Qatari monarchy, where the WTO was scheduled to meet in November 2001 for the first time since Seattle. The contrast in cities was symbolic of the profound changes that had taken place in the intervening 2 years. A global medicines access movement had come of age and shamed the drug-producing countries into allowing a global trade in generic combination therapies. Now the same forces were pushing to institutionalize that permission. The naming rights on French cheese would not top the TRIPS agenda in Doha. The September 11th attacks on New York and Washington, meanwhile, had downshifted drug patents as a matter of Western diplomatic concern. Just 2 weeks before the Doha talks began, the world was treated to the related spectacle of the Bush administration threatening to infringe on the patent of a U.S. drug company, Bayer, over the price of its branded anthrax medicine, Cipro. The Department of Health and Human Services told Bayer it was prepared to contract with the generic drug maker, Bar Industries, unless it reduced its offer price of $1.38 per tablet. When Bayer agreed to sell the drug for under $1, Washington's 5-year campaign to protect 1,000% monopoly markups on AIDS drugs was fresh in the memory of the developing world. And here it was invoking its sovereign right to disregard patents over 90 cents, all in preparation for a far-fetched threat to the health and safety of a hypothetical American city. Canada, another member of the U.S.-led patent quad, also threatened infringement if Bayer did not lower its price. The Doha talks ended with the first revisions to the TRIPS regime established in 1994. Language was added that recognized the right to prioritize people over patents as a matter of policy, not just during public health emergencies. The TRIPS agreement does not and should not prevent members from taking measures to protect public health. The right to issue compulsory licenses was expanded and clarified. Developing nations praised the changes, as did Médecins Sans Frontières, now the leading international voice of the medicines access movement. But the Doha TRIPS reforms had a hole at their center. The power to issue compulsory licenses and manufacture generics for domestic use is meaningless if a country lacks a native medicine manufacturing base. It would take another 2 years to enshrine the right of third-party nations like India to fill orders and ship generics under TRIPS protection. As with Bayh-Doyle critics in the U.S. context, developing countries soon came to suspect that the escape clauses in the TRIPS agreement were never intended to function. The flexibilities written into TRIPS between 2001 and 2003 are only as valuable as the freedom countries enjoy to use them. In practice, that freedom has been constrained by politics, especially the continued pressure exerted by the Western countries. As soon as countries began to see the flexibilities, there was a pushback, says K.M. Gopakumar, a legal advisor on intellectual property issues at the Third World Network, an international think tank focused on issues affecting developing countries. He continued, "You can go down the list from Thailand to Colombia. Countries that seek to issue compulsory licenses face political pressure from the EU and the U.S., the legal wrath of the drug companies, and joint pressure demanding they ratchet up the TRIPS standards. It's a human rights violation that's all about defending the high prices on these patented drugs. For many countries, the Doha flexibilities only exist on paper."